This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Coming up, it's Hurricane Preparedness Week. We have tips to get you ready and early predictions for the 2017 Atlantic hurricane season. Cape Lookout National Seashore is going green. The park will hold a ribbon cutting on Tuesday to acknowledge a new photovoltaic system that provides renewable power to the remote Barrier Island. Until now, the historic site was powered by a combination of diesel generators and shore power. And now, the lighthouse area and keeper's quarters are entirely off the grid and independent of fossil fuel energy. This week, I spoke with maintenance supervisor Steve Sable with Cape Lookout National Seashore about the solar project, which went online last month.
Initial planning for this project began in June of 2016. A project was created and a contracting package was submitted in August. Work actually began on the system November of 2016, and the project was completed March 17th of 2017.
When people actually visit Cape Lookout, are they going to be able to see the solar panels?
The area where the ground array physically sits is not a visitor use area. The public should not enter this area. It contains the solar farm, a deep water well, our potable water filtration system, but the ground array is viewable from a distance or from the top of the lighthouse.
So how many solar panels make up this project, and how much power can it generate?
The ground array itself is 60 panels at 300 watts each. That produces a total of 18,000 watts of electricity. That power feeds four charge controllers and two inverters capable of producing a constant 100-amp service. The system will only utilize one inverter until a demand is placed on the system. At that time, the controller will call for the second inverter to come online.
What's the life expectancy of these solar panels?
25 years before we start losing any efficiency at all. If you compared that to the service life of a diesel generator, and on top of that, the actual diesel fuel that you would consume in that time period, it's evident how much sense it makes to implement these photovoltaic systems in our remote applications.
Steve, what buildings are tied into the photovoltaic system?
Currently, the system powers the light station keeper's quarters, the volunteer quarters, the lighthouse utility lights, a state-licensed potable water system, and a staff break room. A separate system that has been online since May of 2016 supplies power to the Lighthouse Visitor Center and the restroom facility. With the completion of our newest system, all NPS assets in the lighthouse area are now powered by photovoltaic electricity.
Okay, and as I understand, the beacon on top of the lighthouse, not yet powered by solar power, is that right?
The beacon on top of the lighthouse is still serviced by the submerged shore power line cable from Harkers Island. That is still considered a Coast Guard asset, and that is still not on our photovoltaic system at this time.
But I understand that you're currently pursuing a partnership with the Coast Guard that would eventually incorporate the Cape Lookout Lighthouse beacon onto the new photovoltaic system. Are the new solar panels going to be able to handle that load?
So a little bit about that. Right now, the beacon, if we put that load on our system, we would be very borderline as far as the performance of the system. But the Coast Guard is pursuing converting the current beacon to a much more modern, energy-efficient LED beacon. Once that conversion is complete, we will easily be able to power the Cape Lookout light, the beacon itself, with our solar system.
Do you know when that might happen?
Right now, we are working on the agreement between the Coast Guard and the National Park Service, and we hope to have this agreement in place by the year's end.
Okay, so going back to the solar system that's in right now, what do you do when we get several days of cloudy weather? Is there some sort of battery storage system?
Yes. So this system, there is enough battery storage built into this system to sustain us for approximately 5 days without any sunlight at all. We're talking completely pitch black conditions. This system will still produce between 15 and 50% of its capacity, even on an overcast day. We have 2,200 amp hours of battery capacity built into the system. These batteries will power all demands throughout the night or during times of low light. If all else fails, the sun doesn't shine, and the batteries lose all charge, then we still have a 20 kW backup diesel generator.
And lastly, Steve, what are the benefits of this project to visitors of CableCount?
The largest benefit being that this system was initially created as a solution to a looming problem. This area was previously powered by the submerged cable from Harker's Island, the condition of which is deteriorating and the continued service life is unknown. Loss of this power to this area would have been devastating and would have made it all but impossible to continue providing visitor services at the lighthouse area. The new photovoltaic system ensures that all visitor services will continue, that our volunteers will have living quarters with utilities, and that clean potable water will still be provided to all visitors and campers on the island. Visitors to the area will also appreciate the solar system versus the alternative, which would have been a diesel generator operating 24 hours, 7 days a week. The photovoltaic systems that are in place now are silent and minimally invasive to the surrounding environment.
Steve Sable is the maintenance supervisor at CableCount National Seashore. Thank you for speaking with me.
Yep, you're welcome, Jared.
This is the Downeast Journal. Hurricane season is approaching, and emergency management officials are encouraging residents to get ready as part of Hurricane Preparedness Week, which started on Monday. Early unofficial predictions indicate a less than active season along the Atlantic Basin, but experts still warn that's no reason to feel complacent. Chris Thomas has this.
If you want a reliable preview of the year's Atlantic Coast hurricane season, look no further than Fort Collins, Colorado, specifically Colorado State University and its Department of Atmospheric Science.
They're usually quite accurate. They've been doing it for many decades, so they've had a lot of practice in making these forecasts.
Hal Austin is meteorologist for the National Weather Service. The university's 2017 preview was released last month, and 11 named storms are predicted. That would make it the least active season in 3 years, when there were only 8 named storms in the Atlantic.
The average is 12, so just a little bit below normal. Of those named storms, 4 hurricanes and 2 storms of Category 3 or higher.
We may also be in for another round of El Niño, a system that causes warmer-than-average temperatures in the Pacific Ocean and weakens trade winds in the Atlantic Ocean. That system tends to stabilize conditions along the Atlantic coast and minimize the chances of hurricane conditions.
There is about a 50-50 chance of an El Niño developing toward the beginning of hurricane season, so we'll just have to watch that and see.
And a relatively inactive hurricane season doesn't necessarily mean a hurricane-free season. As already mentioned, the Atlantic coast only had 8 named storms in 2014, but one of them was Hurricane Arthur on Independence Day, the earliest recorded hurricane to make landfall in North Carolina. 1992 was also a relatively inactive year on the Atlantic coast, with 7 named storms and 1 major hurricane. That storm was named Andrew, and it was one of the most devastating Gulf Coast hurricanes on record. Though it may reduce the chances of a catastrophic event, Austin says all it takes is one storm to do a world of damage, even if it isn't a hurricane.
Whether we have an El Niño or La Niña season, all it takes is one hurricane, one slow-moving hurricane or tropical storm to dump a lot of rain, and that would cause a lot of problems.
Hurricane Matthew was a Category 1 storm by the time it reached the North Carolina coast and had a moderate storm surge, according to the National Weather Service. But it was the flooding it left in its wake, which put communities along the Neuse and Tar Rivers underwater for weeks, that left the biggest impact. The storm caused more than $1 billion in damage statewide, though it seems the state will only receive about $6 million of support from the federal government. This is Hurricane Preparedness Week, and North Carolina Emergency Services is asking individuals, families, and communities to get ahead of the game and start putting an emergency kit together. Items like battery-powered radios, candles, medicine, cash, and non-perishable foods are staples of these kits.
Always keep your car filled with gas, have extra medicine, non-perishable food on hand. Be sure and watch out for your pets, have extra pet food. Know where to go in case you have to evacuate. Know what highways to take and some of those things.
To avoid physical or property damage, Austin also suggests tending to trees that may pose a danger in case of oversaturation.
If you have any dead or dying trees, go ahead and have them taken down and disposed of if you can. Any shallow-rooted trees that might be blown over in a hurricane, you should shore them up or just remove them and make sure they don't fall on your house or your vehicle.
Atlantic hurricane season officially begins June 1st. The National Weather Service will release their official storm prediction toward the end of May. No definite release date has been announced, but it should be expected by Memorial Day weekend. I'm Chris Thomas.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the 29th Annual Beaufort Music Festival, May 19th and 20th in downtown Beaufort. This two-day event features musical acts from around the country and right here in eastern North Carolina. Mac McKee speaks with co-director Sarah Phillips about the Beaufort Music Festival next weekend.
How many bands or performers do you have coming this year to the Beaufort Music Festival, and what are some of the performers you're looking forward to listening to?
Well, that's a great question. As you're asking it, I'm actually counting to make sure. We have quite a few this year. I think at this point, including a lot of the smaller local acoustic acts, we have close to 20 different bands. So both Friday night and Saturday all day, we have, I think, about 18 bands, and really all of them are top-notch. We are really excited about some of the more well-known bands. The Polyrhythmics is an 8-piece world music band coming all the way from Seattle. We also have Big Sam's Funky Nation, which is a kind of a classic New Orleans jazz type band coming straight from New Orleans. We also have another girl, Caroline Dare, who is 17, and she's from North Carolina, but already has a Nashville recording contract. So there are some really, really top-notch musicians coming. And then we have some of the bands that are coming this year have come to the music festival before. Matt Walsh from the Low Counts is very well-known here in Beaufort. We also have Darkwater Rising, which is a band from North Carolina, and L-Shaped Lot is everyone's favorite. They're from Wilmington, and they have played in and around Beaufort and as well as at the music festival before.
Well, that sounds like quite a lineup for 2 days. Now, you've been co-chair for quite a while, and you've seen it grow. How many folks do you expect to be in Beaufort the weekend of the festival?
Well, it's hard to know because it is a free festival. It's hard to count the number of people in and out, but we expect over 1,000 people during the entire weekend, and is most of those people are local to Carteret County and mostly to Beaufort and Atlantic Beach and Moorhead City, but we've really been working with other partners in New Bern and Kinston and even up into the Triangle to bring more people in this year. So we really are hoping for one of the biggest festivals in recent memory this year.
Parking in Beaufort is always at a premium, but with 1,000 or more people descending on a weekend, how is parking going to work for the festival?
Yeah, so that is always an issue, and especially this year we're doing it a little bit differently with the stages being set up. So we are in the same place as prior years. One of the main stages will be in the Beaufort Historic Site, which is right downtown. And then this year we're actually setting up the second stage across the street from the Beaufort Historic Site in the church parking lot off of Turner Street. So we will have a small portion of Turner Street in downtown closed. So that will be a little bit confusing to people that are trying to get downtown. However, there are many other small roads that you can get around and get into an easy parking space. So As always with large events in Beaufort, basically it's kind of first come, first serve. There is free parking on Front Street. They have not started charging for parking yet. They don't do that until the end of May. Beaufort, as people know, is really easy for biking and walking, and that's something that I will be doing, setting up my car and then biking everywhere during the day.
It's always been you, you, you. It's always been you, you, you. It's always been you, you, you. It's always been you.
Each year, the Beaufort Music Festival donates a portion of the proceeds to a local organization or person in need. Now, this year, it's the Boys and Girls Club of Coastal Carolina. How long has the tradition of giving back to the community been a part of the Beaufort Music Festival, Sarah?
Yeah, we're really excited about partnering with the Boys and Girls Club this year and donating money. So it's been part of the music festival's goals since the beginning, and this is the 29th year. So we've always tried to donate a portion of the proceeds to a deserving local charity, school, or individual. And I do think that the Boys and Girls Club is probably going to be our partner moving forward for the next couple of years.
The Beaufort Music Festival gets underway Friday, May 19th, and Saturday, May the 20th, at the Beaufort Historic Site, mainly. What time do the festivities start each day, Sarah?
Yeah, so Friday afternoon, the music starts right on the Beaufort Historic stage at 5 o'clock. So the first band begins right at 5. They're a local band right here in Carteret County. And we will have a smaller stage that a couple of small local groups will be doing some acoustic sets in between. And then on Saturday, Turner Street will be, just that small portion of Turner Street will be closed. And the music on Saturday starts right around 11:30. So it's an early start on Saturday and goes until almost 12 hours later. We'll still have music. The music ends around 10:30 on Saturday night.
Thanks, Sarah, for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Thank you.
Be sure to check out the ENC events calendar for more information at publicradioeast.org.
This is the Down East Journal. Breweries and wineries have been proliferating in the state in recent years. Another branch of the alcohol beverage industry is also currently trying to make its presence known. George Olson has more.
North Carolina has had a complicated history with alcohol. Wilkes County was once proclaimed the moonshine capital of the world, while North Carolina banned alcohol about 10 years prior to the start of Prohibition and only removed the ban about 5 years after the 18th Amendment creating Prohibition in 1919 was repealed in 1933.
Back in the day, before Prohibition in the late 1800s, there were, it's hard to quantify exactly, but from some quick Google research I did, we had close to 500 distilleries. Now, a lot of these were on farms and very small operations. But back in the so-called day, North Carolina was a booming distiller, and that all ended, obviously, with Prohibition.
John Francis Trump, who is writing about the return of craft spirits to the state in his book, Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State. It's been a slow process, the legal kind at least. Trump notes legal distilleries weren't allowed until 1979, and the first to open was Piedmont Distillers in Madison in 2005. His book highlights about three dozen distillers, all making a variety of high-quality spirits from gin to rum to vodka to whiskey, but many of them giving an appreciative nod to North Carolina's notorious bootlegging past.
Jeremy Norris in Benson, who also makes moonshine, and Copper Barrel makes moonshine too. Broad Branch makes moonshine. And where these recipes come from, they come from 100-year-old, longer. The Calls, for example, taught some guy named Jack Daniel how to make liquor, a descendant of the Calls, who was a Baptist minister who was forced to give up his still for pressure from his congregation. So they've got such a history in it. And now there's no classification, so to speak, for moonshine. There's classifications for vodka, for whiskey, for gin, liqueur. But moonshine, there's no government classification. So where you kind of run into a hazy area is what exactly is moonshine, and it's whatever that recipe is, typically corn. And it's based on a tradition.
It's true shine, though perhaps the quality is a bit better than the Prohibition-era spirits were. Jeremy Norris at Broad Slab Distillery in Benson notes his moonshine is made in part from, quote, malted non-GMO corn. And while it sounds odd to talk non-GMO with alcohol, that type of talk isn't necessarily uncommon for the craft spirits industry in the state. It's starting to boom, perhaps not as much as state breweries and wineries, but in a way perhaps more familiar to higher-end restaurants that tout their farm-to-table creds.
Like, for example, I'll go back to Jeremy Norris, who grows his own corn. Typically, whiskey and vodka, even not vodka so much, but corn and wheat are the primary ingredients I think used in North Carolina and are available here. Like, for example, Top of the Hill makes a line of whiskeys and gins from red organic wheat. So they have it available. They have a local farmer. In Lenore, they use apples. Carriage House makes apples from a farmer down the road, Low Orchards. So, and the Department of North Carolina Department of Agriculture deserves a lot of credit too, because they're pushing this. They've been behind us from the beginning, and it's kind of part and parcel with the agriculture and the liquor.
The new craft spirits industry also has an attribute that the state's historical bootleggers would probably never have considered, because that attribute wasn't really a consideration for most business of the time, legal or not.
Thing about this cool about Mother Earth, they and pretty much across the board with distillers, they're very green. They recycle as much as possible. They reuse as much as possible. And now the Mother Earth distillery, where the brewery is there too, and they have a wonderful tasting room, which is, I think, an ode to the owner's trip to London, liked it and kind of replicated it. But they use like blue jeans in the insulation, and they grow a lot of their own plants. They have a rooftop garden.
The Mother Earth that Trump just mentioned is Mother Earth Brewery in Kinston, which also has a distiller on site making gin, rum, and whiskey. It's not too far from another Eastern North Carolina distiller, Covington Spirits in Snow Hill, which embodies the green spirit of the state's craft distillers, taking what would otherwise be thrown away and turning it into, as the website proclaims, the best yam vodka on earth.
Now, I'm not a farmer, so. But when you take the sweet potatoes out of the ground, sometimes people, when you buy them at the store, you want pretty sweet potatoes. And sometimes they get torn up. So some of the people who own Yamco decided, well, we should do something with these sweet potatoes. And somebody came up with an idea, well, let's make vodka. So that's what they do. The sweet potatoes are pureed, basically like baby food is what it looks like. And they are in turn distilled to a high proof, but not high enough that you lose that sweet potato essence. So it's a fantastic vodka.
It's also a vodka with a sense of humor, as Jimbo Eason, the Covington distiller, reminds you that their vodka is gluten-free and gluten-free, satisfying those with both dietary and political restrictions. And a sense of humor might be a requirement to make it in the craft spirits industry in North Carolina. You might wake up tomorrow morning and decide, I want to be a distiller, but there will be a lot of mornings between that initial desire and getting a product to the public.
Typically, it takes several years. I mean, people have done it quicker, but it takes years. There's the labeling process. There's the bottles have to be approved. The labels have to be approved through a couple different agencies. And then all the federal rules and all the state rules. And if you're brewing vodka, it's got to be distilled to a certain proof. And if you're calling it bourbon, it's got to have, so much corn in it to be labeled bourbon.
And selling it is another story. It was only in the Pat McCrory administration that a distiller was allowed to sell a bottle of their product to someone directly after they take a tour, with emphasis on the phrase, a bottle.
Right now, as it stands, distillers can sell one bottle of liquor per year per customer. That's not a bottle of each product. That's one bottle total. And your license is scanned, and so it's tracked. Now, you could send people to ABC stores, but will that person go to the ABC store? Will they get sidetracked?
Tastings at the distillery are limited as well. An ounce and a half straight out of the bottle, no mixers, right after a tour. It's hard to promote your product, too. Covington Spirits, for example, can't offer samples or sell its best yam vodka on earth during the Snow Hill Sweet Potato Festival. There are efforts afoot to ease those restrictions. The General Assembly is currently considering Senate Bill 155, which does various things, loosens the tastings rule, and would allow the sale of up to 5 bottles of product, up from 1. There's other things the distillers would like, to serve mixed drinks, for example, but Trump says they're trying to move state law, as they have to do with their spirits, to make a quality product, with baby steps.
It's our culture, of course, and Baptist versus bootleggers kind of idea way back. But that's what it is. It's amazing that these guys persevere and just bust their butts to make good liquor and sell good liquor and market good liquor with the stringent rules that they're under by the state.
John Francis Trump is the author of Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State, which is published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.